You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Whether you live in the city or the country, it just often seems to be getting harder and harder to find quiet space to think. There's the traffic noise, the beeping of electronic devices, jets flying overhead. Our next guest says a noisy world is making it harder and harder to think.
George Prochnick joins us now. He's the author of the book In Pursuit of Silence, and his piece, I'm Thinking, Please Be Quiet, appeared as an op-ed in the New York Times recently. George, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Well, you start your piece talking about Schopenhauer, who moved to the city and turned the pursuit for quiet into a kind of philosophical quest. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. Schopenhauer was one of the leading minds of the 19th century. And while he had always been someone who was, what we would say today, sensitive to noise, it was when he moved into a larger city that he began to realize that there was a real philosophical problem with noise. And what he came to believe and to write about was that nothing distinguishes the philosopher, or indeed the person with any kind of serious thinking going on in their minds, from anyone else, except the ability to concentrate their thoughts entirely on one subject. And noise, he said, was the number one enemy of this power of concentration because it shatters thought and sends it flying all directions. He compared it to the effect of a large army which was scattered helter-skelter over a countryside and thereby could not accomplish any of its aims.
Well, a lot of cultural observers today are worried about our shrinking attention spans. People talk about not being able, for instance, to read novels anymore. They have to read things that are shorter in bite-sized chunks on the internet. Do you think noise is part of that?
I think it certainly is, and it's particularly disturbing in terms of young people who grow up with these levels of acoustical assault that are just so beyond what any generation really has had to deal with in the past. You know, it's a bit of a tricky issue because if we look at a city in the Industrial Revolution, a large city like London, it was possible that you would be living next to, say, a major manufacturing site. In a sense, it would be more likely than today because there was less urban zoning. But what you also had was more refuges of silence for the broader populace. It wasn't what it's become today that I worry about as more of a kind of boutique commodity luxury. I mean, if you have money today, you can find silence. But there are, as I found when I was researching the book, millions and millions of people who really move from loud homes to loud streets to loud shopping to loud schools, and they just have no respite from it. And it's the interruption of noise to give you time to focus yourself that seems particularly important for our cognitive and indeed our larger physiological health.
Now, my sense is that the world has gotten noisier. I walk into a restaurant sometimes and I can't even carry on a conversation with people because it's so loud. And I think that acoustically they're meant to be loud these days so that there's a sense of hubbub and things happening. But am I right about that? Is the world getting louder or has it always been loud?
Well, this is precisely what I was starting to say in response to your last question. I think that it's tricky to make the case that it's louder in terms of decibel level everywhere. But what is the case is that there is less room to escape from the noise. And I think it's the envelopment in noise that is particularly damaging. I spoke with a number of teachers who talked about the hyperactivity of their children, all these issues with attention deficit, and many of them attributed it to the way that they were always plugged into something. There was never a moment really in their days when there wasn't some kind of auditory input going on that was really beyond what they could handle without getting jazzed up. And I think it's really important to remember that sound waves are a form of energy and they do pump us up. It's part of why in restaurants today, even it just seems de rigueur to have loud music because people want that sense of high energy as something stimulating to it. Not to conversation, but to how much people drink in particular in the sense that they're having a good time. I worry that really there may be a kind of, at this point, almost a physiological addiction to noise. We know that noise can trigger the release of dopamine. And when I hear so many places that are so unnecessarily loud, gyms, for example, also, there's a clear sense that we're craving that energy and doing so at the expense of more reflective forms of thought and intimacy with loved ones and a whole range of concentration activities demanding concentration.
There's a whole lot of research out now that the human brain is pretty plastic, that it can change and adapt. And I wonder if it's still true, do you think, that we do need quiet to think, or do you think our brains will just adapt to things being noisier and that we'll be able to concentrate despite the noise?
I think that it is quite possible that this, that what's going on now, based on conversations that I had with neuroscientists working in various fields, that it's quite possible that this current level may be more than something we can process and adjust to. You know, and here we have to look beyond the specific auditory effects of noise on at its larger impact on our cardiovascular system and our overall health. You know, our hearing is incredibly sensitive. It developed, mammalian hearing developed as an early warning system. The primate ancestors that our own hearing developed from were very small and navigating a world with lots of large predators. They were nocturnal, and noise was how they determined where a threat was in space, and so that they could run away from it. We have this hearing that can actually amplify sounds in our ears from what they are in the atmosphere several hundred times. So we have this incredibly acute sensitivity that is so hardwired into us and so hardwired into us as something that has to be responded to as a threat that I don't know if we can really override this overall systemic response. You know, there's enormous evidence from WHO-funded studies, sponsored studies, and other very rigorous scientific studies that are looking at the risk to heart damage and also all sorts of different kinds of stresses to our physiological system because of noise.
Well, and there's some interesting research that you write about, it's kind of scary research too, about the effects of the noise that jet engines make flying overhead when people are sleeping. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I was particularly struck by this because it's obvious, or relatively obvious at least, that for people who are woken by airplane traffic, that there's going to be some degrading effect on their health. But there was a very damning study done several years ago that looked at what the noise of air traffic did, even to people who managed to sleep through the sounds of jets overhead. And what these studies found was that even when there was no perception, at least, of waking, that there was a massive release of stress hormones, blood pressure elevated, pulse went up, there was vasoconstriction. All of the markers to the body being extremely stressed were caused, even when subjects remained completely asleep, as far as they knew at least. And worst, in a way, after these people left their homes for up to 6 hours afterwards, even if they worked in relatively quiet environments, those effects continued to resonate. And, you know, since it's 9-1-1, I'm going to just tell one very quick anecdote that speaks to this same issue. One of the worst areas of noise pollution today is actually noise pollution affecting marine animals because of shipping. And there were studies looking at stress hormones, different kinds of stress markers in whales that began in the late 1990s and were continuing in the early 2000s. In the immediate aftermath of 2001, there was an enormous drop in shipping in the oceans, and whales that were examined in the weeks following September 11th were discovered to have a radical drop in those stress hormone buildups that had been causing all sorts of disturbances to their migratory patterns, their feeding patterns, etc.
Wow. So, but you're saying we're not that different from whales. We pick up
I'm
on the stress.
I'm saying we're not. And I think that the problem is we take for granted the situation that there's nothing that can be done about this onslaught of noise. And yet I believe that if there was more of a kind of political will to make silence something that was more democratically accessible, that there are things that can be done. I mean, there are, you know, I spoke with one urban planner who said something that was really fascinating to me. He talked about how difficult it was to lower the decibel level in any given urban space, even by a few decibels that would be hardly perceptible. You have to reroute traffic and you have to get rid of HVAC systems, et cetera, et cetera. But what's not so hard is to create small, relatively contained spaces where people can find some kind of quiet refuge. You know, you can make little tiny parks with maybe a water feature and plantings that encourage biodiversity, that encourage birds to come, that birdsong is something that almost everyone finds a beneficial sort of sound. And you can make ways for people to break up the noise in their day. And I think it's vital, you know, that we both recognize the magnitude of the situation now and understand that there are things we can do as a society if we're willing to invest a little bit in trying to change the situation.
One thing that was interesting, a while back I interviewed a fellow whose name escapes me now, but he took a vow of silence for several years. And it seems as though a lot of us, even a few moments of silence now, are kind of shocking to the system. We're so unused to quiet. Does it freak some people out to be in the presence of it now?
I think that's correct, and it's another resistance to encouraging more of it. I mean, you know, I would say that silence has been largely ghettoized along two tracks right now. First, what I mentioned before about it being a privilege for the rich who can go to some resort that encourages silent meditation or what have you, and then within certain religious traditions. But the problem for those people who are not believers of a branch of religion that encourages silence is that silence does force people to also confront these larger abysses. At least it can. It can raise questions. It forces you to confront yourself. I spent time in a Trappist monastery myself, and monks spoke about silence to me, about silence compelling a confrontation with the self. And this fear that silence induces prevents people from recognizing the full range and even playfulness that can also be part of what silence offers people. We have to sort of expand our notion of
it. All right, we're going to leave it there and come back and talk further with George Prochnick about why we need quiet to think deeply.
And we want to hear what you think. Is there enough quiet in your life? Where do you go to get it? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. More to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with George Prochnick now. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times recently about the need for quiet thinking space in the world. And we're getting your take on where you go when you want to find true silence and whether or not you agree that we need quiet space to think. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's pick up, George, by talking about some of the benefits of silence. We talked about some of the health effects that are negative when things are too noisy for our bodies. What's good for us about quiet?
Well, number one, certainly, I think there's, at this point, a good deal of evidence by that came out of scientific studies looking at the effects of silent meditation on people's ability to concentrate. But I think even going beyond that specific point, there's something good as a society for the whole in practicing, in pursuing silence more intently. And there's a fascinating story regarding moments of silence, commemorative moments, such as many of us experience today. Those seem to have begun. It's a little bit difficult to know historically where they started, but we know that there were moments of silence following the armistice in Great Britain. Those are the first really well-documented ones. And in fact, they proved so popular that the BBC began recording just the 2 minutes of silence that marked the day. And at one point, someone was asked in the 1920s, someone at the BBC was asked, well, why is this so powerful? And this gentleman said was that the silence became a solvent which destroyed personality and gave us leave to be great and universal. There was some sort of solidarity that was nurtured by silence. And I think that this is something many of us crave in our current culture, which has so much dissonance on not just politically but culturally and in so many areas. And sometimes just being together in silence is a way of feeling something larger than ourselves and something that brings us together as a people.
Well, I want to go to the phones. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll start with Eva in Hubertus. Hi, Eva.
Hi.
What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. I wanted to say I really appreciate the speaker's comments on this, because I really feel, I think as a society, we have been so supercharged with noise all around us, and we have a very hard time getting down to silence, coming down off of our iPads, our iPhones, our music in the background. And I think one of the times that I've really realized this in my life is when the power would go out in our house, and you would just, and it's infrequent, maybe once a year, twice a year, but you just hear no hum in the background, and you realize how much noise is actually around you just from your daily environment in your house. And for me, my place to go and seek some of the quiet that I desire is, I think, in northern Wisconsin in the woods, and going for walks up there, going out on a sailboat and enjoying a quiet afternoon. And that really helps me psychologically to kind of achieve a balance from the noise around me, whether it's my children. I teach high school. I have a lot of noise in the building, you know, in my teaching environment. And so this is really a great topic, and I appreciate his comments. And I think in terms of the unifying thing, that's something that we would really have to train our population to go after, is to be able to have moments where we unify with silence as the unifying factor, maybe around another cause. So I will sign off at that point. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thanks so much, Eva. George?
Well, I think those are lovely comments. And in fact, your remarks about the powerful effect of having the power go off repeats an anecdote that or echoes an anecdote that I talk about in this opinion piece. It's amazing. I spoke with a woman at one point who lived in a very remote part of Newfoundland, and she had a similar experience in her home, even though she didn't have lots of noise outside, just recognizing all of these small assaults of noise that were affecting her and her family all the time, and what a wonderful feeling it was when suddenly those were gone, when the electricity went out on one occasion. So I think that sends a message that we're being stressed even without being conscious of something as intense as, say, the passage of a jet plane, and we really need to find the sorts of oases that you were able to pursue in the woods. And I hope more people are able to make those kinds of escapes.
All right. Thank you for that call. And we move next to William calling from Merrill. Hey, William.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, what do you think?
I think I once again thank you again for your programming, and to your guests, thank you so much for bringing up these issues. I would just like to say that I really do appreciate that bringing up both the psychological issues with noise pollution, and along with that the mental aspects that happen. But I never really paid attention to the physiological aspects. But I've seen now personally myself, I find refuge and putting a pair of headphones on and listening to music but every now and then it is also stepping outside into a nice quiet environment and sitting down meditating that way also. But as a new father with stepchildren and a newborn, I've noticed that, you know, maybe thanks to this issue of being brought up right now, maybe I should kind of delegate some minimalist time of everyone sitting down in a nice quiet alone by themselves. I've noticed in my 8-year-old stepson that he's pretty much plugged into video games, and that's how he finds himself, whereas opposed to my little girl, she can go off to her room and play with her toys and have her own imagination, and she's bringing herself out, you know, and she's not bringing she's bringing a story she's made up out, not following somebody else's story. And I think that's a great concern that we have to face, is that imagination and basically ourselves are being dwindled by, you know, other aspects around us. And I appreciate you bringing that up again. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, William. And he raises a good question. What are some baby steps that we can take toward having quiet when we're used to being kind of more plugged in?
Well, I think I also thank you for that call. I think everything you said was very eloquent. I want to respond first, though, quickly to what you said about your children, and I do encourage you to as a first step, to make sure that there is time for your son that is unplugged time, that is time where he is not being really subject to a kind of barrage of noise, which is often
it's demonstrably overwhelming to for their ability to really cultivate a self. And let me just tell one quick story. I was at a friend's house recently, and they were playing Sesame Street, which I hadn't seen in many years, and it seemed so loud and so fast and so noisy in every sense. And I thought, that, wow, this is educational television. And I went back and I rented the very first Sesame Street made from a long time ago now. And by comparison, it seemed like Sesame Street in slow motion. It was so gentle and so human. Mm. And the children were completely engaged, but everything was at a pace that it was true to the imagination of a child. And I thought, putting these two episodes next to each other, how could children not have these problems with hyperactivity and attention issues if this is what they're subject to, even within the realm of educational television? So yes, finding ways to just give your kids a break from that, to take them outside, take them on walks, make them as much as you can unafraid of silence, and finding in silence an opportunity for different sorts of explorations.
All right, let's take one more quick call, and that's going to Shannon in Kenosha. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share my experience. I'm an avid backpacker, and I spend a lot of time in the backcountry, in the mountains, in canyons, specifically in the Grand Canyon. And my husband and I spend a lot of time, sometimes up to 7, 10, 12 days out with our backpacks. And after a few days away from the noise, the silence begins to have a fullness to it. And it's actually kind of disconcerting when you come back to the rim and to the busyness and where all the tourists are usually congregated. And it can almost be a bit of a stressful experience after having been out in the silence for so many days, coming back into the normal activity of life.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Shannon. And George, you've got about a minute for your response.
Well, it's another powerful story that you've told, and it reminds me of a comment by Thoreau, who said that silence has different depths and fertility, like soil. And that sense of fullness you describe is a presence. I mean, and that's one other thing that I would encourage people to recognize. Looking for more silence in your life is not looking for the void. It's not looking for emptiness. In fact, it's looking to be more aware of all the smaller sounds and all the beautiful, more lyrical sounds that fill the world, if only they're not washed over by these intense man-made infrastructure noises, commercial noises, entertainment noises. You know, pursuing silence for me is really about hearing more, not hearing less. It's just about hearing things that are more delicate and enriching. And it's no wonder to me that you would come back and find something stressful in returning to the environment that we've allowed to become, in many cases, kind of a sonic dumping ground, I'm afraid.
Well, George, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
We've been talking to George Prochnik, the author of the book In Pursuit of Silence.
Coming up, we'll find out how museums are making the transition to the online world with the director of the Smithsonian.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.